all the best Bitcoin works read aloud so that you can listen. This is a Cryptoconomy Quick Read. What is up, guys? Welcome back to the show. We have got a really fun but short read today, so we should be able to get through it pretty quickly because I have a number of other really fun things to finally finish up, and I'm very happy to be closing these things out. I've been seeing the end of the tunnel here for the beginning of the week. But today we are reading, this is actually by Citizen Bitcoin. If you don't know the Citizen Bitcoin podcast, I've been on his show numerous times. I love Brady and Tommy. They're awesome. I went to Bitcoin 2020 with them last year. Brady wrote a short but really great article on the idea that we are default Keynesians. So I wanted to hit it and just kind of share my thoughts on it a little bit because I think you guys will enjoy it. With that, let's go ahead and jump into the article. And then we'll do Guy's Take afterward. And it's titled, "We're All Default Keynesians Now, and How Bitcoin is Changing That." We're all Keynesians now. Milton Friedman coined the phrase, often miscredited to Richard Nixon, back in 1965. And that hasn't changed since then. Unless you began your Austrian economic education at birth in some unknown Austrian paradise, on this planet, at this particular time in human history, I think we can safely say we're all Keynesians by default. What is a default Keynesian? A default Keynesian is a person who, probably unwittingly and passively, supports the centralized monetary and fiscal policies that are descended from the ideas of economist John Maynard Keynes, simply because that's the way things are now. Who's John Maynard Keynes? He's a dead economist whose ideas currently have an effective ideological monopoly on the global economy. Why does this matter? There are excellent resources available to help you understand what money is and to learn its history, but here's the gist. Humans discovered money as a solution to the problems of barter, described by economists as the coincidence of wants problem. Human society arrived at a consensus or shelling point that gold is the best money. Over and over again through history, humans figured out how to centralize the power to control gold and inflate its value beyond its natural historical inflation rate of about 1.5 to 2%, simply the amount of gold we mine from the earth every year. Most recently, this human drama took place through the creation of the U.S. Federal Reserve in 1913, the global agreement to use the gold-backed dollar as the global money, the Bretton Woods Agreement, in 1944, and the removal of the U.S. dollar from the gold standard by Nixon in 1971. Since then, central banks around the world, including the United States Federal Reserve, have over and over again inflated the money. They make printing it sound complicated and wise with lots of big words. Really, it amounts to instantly creating more digital dollars out of thin air and giving it to big banks to lend or using it to buy lots of equities. Keynes played a key role in all of this by providing academic justification for government and central bank intervention during recessions through monetary policy, reduction of interest rates, and fiscal policy, government spending. The problem is that it is all too easy for central banks and governments to lower interest rates, print money, and spend it in the face of a recession, as it is usually a popular thing to do in the short run. But the countercycle actions prescribed by Keynes to raise interest rates and taxes when the economy is growing are less popular and often never happen. Keynesianism gives credence to the conceit that a few people can effectively improve the function of money in an economy by controlling it. Governments and central banks love that idea for obvious reasons. The current world economic order is run by Keynesian thinking. It's simply the way things are now. But now, there's another way. The red pill at the bottom of the rabbit hole. Bitcoiners love analogizing Bitcoin. Mycelium and mushrooms, a tree, a social contract, a virus, a cure, digital gold, magic internet money. Two of the most loved are the red pill from The Matrix and the rabbit hole from Alice in Wonderland. These two are invoked so often because they get at an idea that Bitcoin leads to an education, or re-education, on many fascinating topics. Chief among these topics is that Bitcoin is teaching us default Keynesians en masse what money really is, and this is the most important lesson Bitcoin teaches us. What money really is. These days, like many before them, we're forced to use certain monies by the decree and enforcement of national governments and monarchs. But this isn't what money really is. This is what we Bitcoiners refer to as fiat money. Despite what default Keynesianism has us believing, money isn't that complicated. Money is simply a good, asset, or technology that is determined by the free market of human commerce to be useful to solve the problems of barter and store of value of your labor over time. Money has network effects, just like the internet itself and the social networks that are built on top of it. Austrian economics hypothesizes that, left alone by central authorities, human markets will naturally converge on the best money, often called sound money. As mentioned above, humans have throughout history converged on gold as the most sound form of money. Gold, however, was unable to escape control by central authorities, so human societies have been engaged in a swing back and forth between sound money and some debased, inflated version of it. A new option. Bitcoin is the best money we've found. The technological miracle of Bitcoin is that Satoshi invented a sound money able to resist capture by central authorities. It is the first good asset or technology able to be free to operate as money for a global human economy. It is unable to be confiscated, censored, debased, or inflated. Bitcoin is a profound 0-to-1 moment, and the implications for human society are nothing short of revolutionary. The re-education of the default Keynesian masses. The collection of economic ideas that has persisted as an alternative, like heroic cockroaches after a Keynesian ideological Armageddon, is called Austrian economics. Austrian economic thinking has been carried forth by small groups of devotees to the academic tradition of Mises, Hayek, and Rothbard, political bands like the Libertarians of the United States, and speculators like the Goldbugs. The first Bitcoiners were the cypherpunks, who came mostly for the tech. The next wave brought the libertarians and gold bugs, who came mostly for the sound money. Based on my observation of available literature, public internet communications, and my private conversations with Bitcoiners, it appears to me that both of these groups skewed heavily toward awareness of Austrian economic ideas compared to the general population. I ran a Twitter poll earlier this week to ask Bitcoiners about when they first started learning Austrian economic ideas, before or after they discovered Bitcoin. Tweet by Citizen Bitcoin. Did you start learning Austrian economic ideas before or after you fell down the Bitcoin rabbit hole? 34% say before, 66% say after, with 3,161 votes. The results surprised some seasoned Austrian economics devotees. Right now, with a significant sample set, it appears that fully two-thirds of Bitcoiners have been introduced to Austrian economic ideas by Bitcoin. We're in a new wave of Bitcoin, one in which most new Bitcoiners are default Keynesians being taught what money really is by Bitcoin itself. Two great experiments. We are now in the midst of competing experiments of epic proportions. Central banks and governments around the world have gone all in on centralized, inflationary, monetary, and fiscal policies. And the first sound money able to resist control by central authority is competing against this centralized model of money control. Austrian economics has a new and better horse in the race. Where gold inevitably wore down in the face of the constant pressures to centralize control of money, Bitcoin seems able to resist and indeed actually grow stronger in the face of centralization pressures. We know very well from history that humans will centralize control of money if it is at all possible, and the value of centralized money is proven to be inevitably debased and inflated away. As the first sound money, resistant to central control, Bitcoin is wealth insurance against the historically probable eventualities of the centralized control of money. It's downright rational for all default Keynesians to hodl Bitcoin, because the way things are now is no longer how it always has to be. There are default Bitcoiners being born every day. Learn more. A good next step is to read Saifedean Ammous's A Bitcoiner's Guide to Austrian Economics. It's full of references to source material and or listen to Stefan Lavera's podcast episode Intro to Bitcoin Austrian Thought. If you're ready to dive into some source material, check out these books from Gigi's Bitcoin Resources. Thanks for reading. Please share it if you liked it. Check out the Citizen Bitcoin podcast if you haven't yet. And also, since Bitcoin is making me a shameless capitalist, I've got a shirt to sell you. It supports the pod. It's a, the image that he's got here is a Citizen Bitcoin shirt with the Citizen Bitcoin logo. And then it says default Keynesianism, or excuse me, default Keynesian Recovery Center on it. It's a good shirt. I'll leave a link to it if you guys want to get your default Keynesian shirt. All right, so let's hit our sponsor real quick, and we will jump back in, and I want to talk a little bit about this piece before we close the episode. All right, a thank you to Brady for writing this article. This was published on Medium, and I don't think I said at the beginning, but this was actually published like right in the middle of last year. Where was it? June 21st, 2019. So if you caught that, like a couple of his references were slightly dated, that's why. Most specifically talking about the fact that you shouldn't be looking in his timeline back a week for that poll that he ran, because that's about 8 months old now. But Brady and I have had a couple conversations about the whole default Keynesian thing, and I love that idea. I may even get my own shirt, to be honest. And it's a fascinating way to look at it, because like that's one of the things about like our understanding of money is really based in the fact that there's never an exploration of it. Like never in government schools do we like break down what money is. Like it's just this always present, never discussed thing that is absolutely critical to human society. And I think that's an unbelievable disservice to intellectual curiosity, to the fact that like just that alone, I think, is such a profound testament to the failure of government schools, that they explicitly, that it's being used more than anything, and that its greatest influence is in the fact that it's not teaching something that's so important, and not teaching many other things that are so important, that it just chooses to ignore those things which are inconvenient for the institution that decide what we learn. I don't care how justified and how important it would seem that everyone needs to be educated, quote unquote, but I don't see any way, historically, like I don't see any significant evidence that government schools is how we do that. In fact, just the opposite. We are increasingly less and less educated as time goes on. I think if you truly believe that people should all be educated, that government schools are the absolute worst way to do that. If you want people to be educated in the sense of being intellectually curious, to know how to defend their own ideas, to truly understand something rather than regurgitate it, that system is not what, that's not what is produced. Anyway, I don't want to get off onto a huge tangent about government schools, here's a quote. I'm one of the first ones that I kind of highlighted here in this piece. Quote, Keynes played a key role in all of this by providing academic justification for government and central bank intervention during recessions through monetary policy, the reduction of interest rates, and fiscal policy, government spending, end quote. in kind of my studies of Keynes and like the kind of history that unfolded there, and I guess you could say maybe the coincidences that played out, but more importantly, the like how it is that Keynes really came to dominate the world, at least the Keynesian theory. And it was published back in like the 30s, I think it was like 1931 or something like that. I can't remember. It's something like that. I'm sure it's a little bit off on the top of my head. But I've always kind of thought Keynes was an opportunist, that he really saw an opportunity to tell the government, and maybe I'm wrong, maybe he actually believed what he believed. But I've always wondered if there was a degree of kind of self-denial in the fact that he was telling the government what they desperately wanted to hear and giving it a, it provided academic justification. It gave it this perception of, oh, it's science, and allowed an academic defense of something that they already desperately wanted to do. I mean, like, think about the idea that someone gave scientific sounding justification for you having the only tree in all the world in which the leaves that grow on it are made of money. Like that you are the tree, you know, the money doesn't grow on trees. You are the only one with that tree, and someone has published a paper that says that you should be the only one with that tree, and in fact, you should be able to use that tree in order to fix the world. I know I would give that person an award, and the state is the most powerful institution in society, in any nation. Like it is the nation. So with all their monetary authority and their prestige, they put him up on a pedestal. They give him awards, they sing his praises, they hire economists that think like him, they hire him, and then they start teaching his horse shit in government schools. And you know, 10 generations later, we are all default Keynesians because that is what most benefited the institution that decided what we got to learn. This is why such a thing should never, ever be centralized. To decide what people will think throughout all of their youngest, their most susceptible years, is a powerful as great and as dangerous as the power to print money. And the fact that it's so easily excused away with, oh, but everybody benefits from, you know, other people being educated, the fact that it's so easy to excuse it with that makes it all the more dangerous. Because, like, when something goes wrong, it's going to get the default assumption that everything's, that we've still made the right choice. All right, back to Keynesianism. So, the general idea of Keynesianism is that, well, I mean, that governments and central banks should control the money, that they play a key role in manipulating the money in order to smooth out economic shifts, you know, booms and busts and all this stuff. There are cycles in the economy. If nothing else, there are seasonal cycles. You know, like there's always movement in the economy. And the reality is, if you look at go back to the use of knowledge in society, go back to any understanding we just broke down in Parker Lewis's piece of what the price system actually is. It's a means of communication. So to say that the economy shifts back and forth and that there are waves, is to say that things change. And it's like, well, no shit. Like, duh. That is a truism of the world. Things change, and prices should adjust to communicate what change has happened. It's an absolutely critical role of the function of money in society, of the function of spreading the knowledge without everyone having to be informed of it. Like change those dials in the economy, as Parker Lewis gave in his example of or his analogy of like an engineer watching dials, is that we can react to the price of things and adjust to thousands of different new truths that have unfolded in, you know, the past couple of weeks or months or whatever it is, and take the correct action in response, even though we have no idea what any of those new developments might be. Another quote real quick says, Keynesianism gives credence to the conceit that a few people can effectively improve the function of money in an economy by controlling it. Governments and central banks love that idea for obvious reasons, end quote. And it's so true. Like, what it does is it gives unbelievable power to someone under the pretense of knowledge, like the idea that somehow they can know all of the information and respond to it better than the collective actions and decisions and separate knowledge of millions or billions of people through trillions of transactions throughout the economy. I mean, the idea that you can know 1/10 of 1/100 of 1% of what's going on in the economy, of the true reality, rather than some silly, cartoonish, oversimplified narrative, which is what we see of everything, that humanity, like all the stuff in your head, everything in my head, the analogies, all of it amounts to a deeply simplified abstraction of what's really going on. It's a map versus the real territory. You know, you see a couple of trees on a map, you don't get any of the information that the tree is an entire ecosystem with generations and hundreds of different species of things interacting with it that changes the climate in the, you know, the bottom 40 feet of this ecosystem, and like creates its own, separates out, you know, the rain and stuff, and creates these whole ecosystems and this whole life cycle of things that interact and grow and spread with all of its differing stages and lifespans and interactions and competitions. And it's just a tree on a map. Like, it is the most basic abstraction of anything that we have. And that's how we have to see everything. We don't, nobody has the mental capacity to wrap their head around all that crap. And that's the idea that we could control money to fix the economy is literally, it's a suggestion that we can manipulate the map and change some fundamental nature about the trees. All it does is obscure the truth. All it does is hide what we actually can discern from it, the information that we can respond to. And of course they would love that idea. Just like the guy who's got the tree that grows money in his backyard, and somebody just gave a beautiful, heartfelt justification for why he should be the only one with that tree and that he should have the right to use it as he sees fit. I mean, how many people do you know who could actively turn that down? The idea of not being a millionaire for free, not being a billionaire for free, but having unlimited money for free. Would you turn it down? Would you make the statement that, no, this guy's wrong, and that this is terrible, and I'm going to burn down my tree? How easy would it be to justify to yourself that, you know, I'll do it responsibly. I only just barely do it. If somebody else had it, they'd do it way worse than me. I see no way. I see no angels in the world that can hold that power responsibly. And the incentives are so horrifically wrong. I would truly have to believe that humans at our foundation are completely different than what I believe now. Everything that I have learned and experienced of people and myself, and like internal conflict and our justifications and our biases, every single bit of it would have to be fundamentally wrong for me to think that power could ever be used responsibly. But I think time is going to teach us. It is going to teach them a very important lesson in that. And the fact that Bitcoin is making us ask the question that Bitcoin is a better teacher than government schools, because it lays this question before us that creates this intellectual curiosity. Like, I know numerous people in Bitcoin who never really stopped to ask or figure things out for themselves. And I can't think of anything in school. I mean, not to say that I didn't learn anything in school. Clearly, I learned some things. That's a very easy thing to do. I can just accidentally bump in and learn things all the time. I learn things every day. Look at this podcast. I read something. I learn something new every day. Not hard. Doesn't cost $20,000 a year for me to do it. But I've always kind of thought that a lot of intellectual curiosity is just smushed by government schooling. Or at least the public schooling that I went to and that I know many other people had a similar experience. I remember getting out of high school and thinking that I was literally, I was justified and defiant about the fact that I was never going to read again. Like, I just thought it was just an awful thing, and that it was always boring, and it was always grueling, and it really kind of destroyed. Like, I had to kind of recover from that. Luckily, my college experience didn't come with the same problems, and I kind of got back into reading thanks to a couple of fantasy novels that some friends recommended, and I just loved them. And now here I am reading, like, ridiculous technical stuff and Mises and Rothbard, the most dense and wordy pieces of literature in human history. So I guess I went full circle there. But the fact that Bitcoin raises these questions again, raises questions that we just are never told to ask. We're never, almost never allowed to ask. It's just this assumption that money equals the state. Of course the state would control money. What other money is there? How could there be anything other than state money? It's the default assumption. And it's also how completely silly ideas like the fact that our economy is a capitalist one get spread and stay persistent. They don't know that we have 100% socialist money. That the most important good in the society, that which every other good is dependent on its function, is 100% socialist. There's nothing even remotely non-socialist about it. It just is. In Keynesian theory, it's funny, because politics is one of those things that's so, it's so easy to do something that is wanted, but all the hard truths, all the restraint is gone. There's no way, because it's based on a set of incentives to essentially bribe the voters, the people who win are the ones who tell everybody exactly what they want to hear at exactly the right time. And nobody wants to hear that while we're growing, the counter cycle, whereas I didn't actually keep that quote. Let me look at this real quick. Cycle. Okay, yeah. So, quote, "The problem is that it's all too easy for central banks and governments to lower interest rates, print money, and spend it in the face of a recession, as it is usually a popular thing to do in the short run. But the countercycle actions prescribed by Keynes to raise interest rates and taxes when the economy is growing are less popular and often never happen." And that's a key. That's a key dichotomy in the incentive structure of politics and government action that never, ever, ever displease your citizens. And that includes in their ignorance, satisfy their ignorance, particularly when it contests your power or your position or your authority in the government. If you don't please people, well, then you might not get reelected. So you just do whatever pleases them, regardless of whether it's the right thing to do, the smart thing to do, or in any sense whatsoever, not the most retarded thing to do in the situation. And one of those things about Keynesianism is that it is truly backward. It's so funny how often the wrong idea gets pushed or becomes prevalent or becomes the norm. And so often, it's not a little bit off. It's not like some competing, like so far off from the truth as to not make any sense. It's usually the opposite of the truth, because there's this sense of like correlation. It's like those things that in the world that are counterintuitive, or that go against like our natural tendencies to want the easy thing and dislike the hard thing, etc. Like these natural tendencies to push against it leads us, and then the counterintuitive nature of so many things in the world leads us to the exact opposite being what we think. Because we rush to the intuitive answer rather than realize its counterintuitive nature and think beyond stage one. There's a great book, Thinking Beyond Stage One. I think it's by Thomas Sowell, or Thomas Sowell. It's S-O-W-E-L-L. I never really know how to pronounce it. I hear it both ways. Really great book, Thinking Beyond Stage One. And it basically argues that that's the whole point of being an economist, is to not do the very quick intuitive answer, but ask, well, where did that come from? Like when a subsidy pays for corn or makes this cheaper, what did it make more expensive? Where did those workers and that profit come from? Who lost workers when this guy gained workers? The whole Keynesian broken window fallacy. Oh, this guy was saving money and now he's forced to spend it on a window. And the idea that this is economic progress and this is, causes economic stimulus and growth. But the question is, what was he going to spend that savings on? Was it going to be his kid's college education? Was it going to be a new pair of shoes because his has got holes in them? There's a trade-off everywhere. Money, like none of this happens in a vacuum. You must think beyond stage one. And Keynesianism is a profound stage one only sort of thinking. And it's led to the exact opposite of the truth that you should lower interest rates during a recession, that you should increase government stimulus and all of this stuff to cover up the bust. And then during a boom, you should rein it all in. You should raise interest rates. You should raise taxes and take advantage of all of this. When in truth, it's the exact opposite. It's fighting against the natural information that the economy and the market are trying to give us. Like the economy is trying to tell us what the situation is, that we don't have any capital left over, that we need to save, that we need to stop spending and consuming immediately, and we need to prepare for the future, or we're not going to have anything in the future. And that's why interest rates skyrocket during a recession. That's why things get sold off at fire sale prices. That's why there's massive deflation if the credit has outweighed our actual productivity, because that's what we need. We need to reallocate. We need to stop spending on the things that we're wasting and imbalanced, wasting our time and labor and have imbalanced the economy. We have to fix the imbalance. That's what the prices do. They force us to swallow the truth and be like, okay, like we really made a bunch of bad decisions. We over-leveraged ourselves and did not properly see this coming and didn't account for this one event or maybe a bad season, et cetera, et cetera. And now we're paying for it. But that's the hard truth. The university doesn't care about your feelings. I mean, the universe doesn't care about your feelings. And no matter how much you wish you could fly, if you tape a bunch of paper to your arms and jump off a cliff, you're going to die. And patting you on the back and being like, oh, no, don't worry about it. If you believe, you'll fly. That's not going to fix the problem. That's not going to help you. And that's essentially what the government is doing to our economy, is getting us to drink alcohol and get absolutely plastered and telling us that our dreams are going to come true and everything's going to be great as we take our cardboard taped wings onto our arms. And they're pushing us to the edge of a cliff. This is economic science, ladies and gentlemen. What we need are market prices. And we don't have them. What we need is to figure out what the hell's going on. Where is the imbalance? What are all the bad decisions that we've made for the last 30 years? And the only thing that can accumulate that much knowledge into one indicator is the price system. And it would probably give us an interest rate of like 50% today, because we have like 600% debt to productivity ratio. We're so drowning, it's unbelievable. It leads me to another quote, actually, from later on in the article, is that there are two great experiments going on right now. Quote, "We're now in the midst of competing experiments of epic proportions. Central banks and governments around the world have gone all in on centralized inflationary monetary and fiscal policies, and the first sound money able to resist control by a central authority is competing against this centralized model of money control." End quote. People don't realize that this is the greatest economic experiment in the history of the world. Never have there been negative interest rates to this tune. We have the greatest monetary and fiscal imbalances collectively across the globe as we have ever seen in human history. This is truly unprecedented. And the fact that it has been being treated as the mainstream, as if this is just business as usual, and that this is not a psychotic experiment, a straight insanity of monetary policy, not even Keynes would suggest to do this at this point. I don't remember anywhere where he justifies negative interest rates. And Trump just the other day praised negative interest rates. How good of an idea he thought it was. Well, come on, people. Why? When did we all go flat insane? That the cost of wasting future resources today is that the future should pay us for it? Ugh, what a joke. Quote, Austrian economics has a new and better horse in the race, where gold inevitably wore down in the face of constant pressures to centralize control of money. Bitcoin seems able to resist and indeed actually grow stronger in the face of centralization pressures. End quote. And I tell you what, if Bitcoin didn't exist and I had learned and, well, I mean, I was learning. I actually am part of the 33 or 34%, whatever it was, that that learned of Austrian economics and then found Bitcoin. I tell you what, if I was in that position and Bitcoin didn't exist, I would feel really hopeless right now. I would not see any way out of this. I guess I'd be buying gold. I don't know. I never saw it as like a real solution. It was just an escape valve of last resort sort of thing. But I would just wonder if there was any way to solve this problem. Like it's such a massive problem. And the only outcome is devastation without some sort of a solution. It's just finally paying the bill for 100 years of mismanagement collectively stacked on top of each other. That's not going to be a small invoice. We are going to pay massive, like it's going to bleed out a generation, multiple generations probably. And we're just heads in the sand, man. It's so bad. But we do have a way out. We do have a solution. We have one that's so powerful, actually, that it could truly ease the transition in an incredible way. And free so many people from the ridiculous totalitarianism and authoritarian arbitrariness that comes from the manipulation and control of money all over the world, everywhere. Like this is like he said it, like Keynesianism has taken over the world. There is no government that does not gleefully and wholeheartedly accept and use the monopoly power over money. It just, there isn't one. But we have potentially found a way out. Bitcoin is the best money. It's not only a return to just general sound money, and the capacity to exit this safely and with our lives and wealth intact, but that we could exit it on the other side with the greatest sound money we have ever had, with the best monetary tool that has ever existed, that not only would we solve the problems of today, but we would make the past solutions and the past temporary band-aids on it look ridiculous. That this makes gold look silly or like subpar. We didn't get like sort of a solution. We got like the apex predator of solutions. And thank God, because we'd have a hell of a run of it otherwise. I mean, it's still going to be rough and real messy, but nonetheless, it's a messy price and a rough transition to something better, something profoundly better, I think. And, you know, that's why I'm here, as I've said numerous times. And hopefully I can teach you guys a little bit about Austrian economics too. I definitely recommend his little list of stuff, Safetynomics. I have not done the beginner's guide to Austrian economics. In fact, I should probably put that and maybe contact him and see if it's something that he would like Oh wait, it's much shorter than I thought. I thought this was like his. Interesting. Yeah, I could probably do this on the show. Maybe I'll hit him up. This is actually pretty short. But yeah, Stefan Lavera's podcast, Intro to Bitcoin Austrian Thought, that's another really good one. And of course, Gigi's Bitcoin Resources has tons of stuff to check out. And as you all know, we've read numerous pieces on the show about Austrian economics. We got the use of knowledge in society. I've got a couple of pieces, like one or two pieces by Mises, and I think Hayek and Hoppe are kind of the key economists that I go to, because they're easier read. Rothbard, I love him to death, and some of his thoughts are so amazing, but he's hard to read. And Mises, for all his brilliance, is the worst of them all, I think. Very, very difficult to digest his actual written work. One thing I would recommend, though, if you want to read, if you would want to read Human Action, even though that's incredibly dense, and the language is very difficult to follow sometimes, I would recommend Choice by Robert Murphy. It is essentially an easier version. it's a translation of Human Action, and it's a pretty amazing work. So if you could digest it in any form, Robert Murphy does a much better job of simplifying the ideas and making it easier for people today to actually read it and digest it. Okay, we'll close this one out here. Thank you guys so much for listening. And a thank you to Brady for writing this article and for, I'm pretty sure it was kind of his idea, was default Keynesian. Did he even mention that in this? I don't know, but I've only heard it from him and I've loved the idea. And I'll leave you guys a link if you want to get your default Keynesian Recovery Center shirt. That still cracks me up. Thank you guys so much for listening. Don't forget to check out the Citizen Bitcoin podcast. We've had him on this show and vice versa numerous times. And he does some really great stuff and has some wonderful interviews. So definitely worth checking out. All right, guys. Thank you so much for listening. Do not forget to get your tickets for Bitcoin 2020 and BitBlock Boom 2020. They are both getting ever closer. And the closer we get, the higher the prices for those things. I will be at both of them. I've got my housing and the plane tickets and everything worked out now, finally, for all of it. Well, except BitBlock Boom, I don't have housing. We're getting closer, and it's time to pull the trigger if you haven't yet. And for those BitBlock Boom tickets, don't forget about the discount code CC for Crypto Economy. That'll get you 30% off those tickets. That is not a small discount, so do not forget to use that. And I guess that will be everything. Thank you, guys. I love you all. We will be back here with another episode tomorrow. How the hell did my rant go to 30 minutes on like an 11-minute read? Whatever. That'll happen. I am Guy. Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. I will catch you all tomorrow. Love you. Till then, take it easy, guys.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.